WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writer's Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
In a few weeks, the Supreme Court will be back in session, and their docket includes some of the defining issues of the moment: redistricting, collective bargaining, and immigration. Donald Trump's appointee to the court, Neil Gorsuch, was sworn in at the end of the court's previous session in the spring. He filled the seat of Antonin Scalia, who was revered on the right as a leader and innovator of conservative jurisprudence. The judges officially don't make decisions based on their personal politics. Instead, conservatives and liberals on the court tend to divide along a different line, how they view history. That's according to my colleague Jill Lepore. She's a staff writer at the magazine and a professor of history at Harvard. A while back, she wrote a terrific essay about the Supreme Court, history, and law. Jill, I think you should start by describing what you call the history test, not the kind of test you give undergraduates, but explain what that history test is on the Supreme Court.
Sure. Well, unlike the kind of test you give to undergraduates, this one is very difficult to pass because it's quite vague and uncertain. But the court, in trying to make judicial decisions, has several different ways it might use history. One is to look to precedent, that is, the body of earlier legal decisions. Everyone's going to do that to one degree or another. But then there's a broader deference to political, cultural, and social history. And justices sometimes talk about this as a history test. That is to say, does the way we decide this ruling, would it be consistent with the larger historical trends in American culture and life?
That's particularly used in constitutional cases, not criminal or civil cases. It's all at the top.
Right. So if you think about it, the Constitution doesn't have originally a Bill of Rights. Since the Bill of Rights, which is ratified in 1791, people have made other rights claims. And then the problem is, where do you find those rights?
So for example, what's a good case to sketch that out?
So the classic instance is the right to privacy, on which so much of our contemporary political debate hinges. The right to privacy is not written in the Constitution, certainly not in so many words. It is discovered in the Constitution in a case from 1965 called Griswold v. Connecticut. Estelle Griswold was the head of the Planned Parenthood Clinic in New Haven, Connecticut, and she challenged the constitutionality of bans on contraceptive services. And her lawyers argued that these bans were unconstitutional because they violated a right to privacy, which the Supreme Court agreed was to be found in the Bill of Rights in between the words as they are written, in the sort of spaces, in the kerning spaces between the letters themselves, was to be found the idea of privacy, and that it was therefore a fundamental right. But in Roe v. Wade in 1973, the justices did something a little different. They offered a historical rationale for the right to privacy. That is, Justice Blackmun looked at the history of abortion law in the United States to point out that only fairly recently had abortion become a crime, and therefore that a right to privacy did pass, in a way, this de facto history test.
So there's a general sense that conservative justices look to history and liberal justices look to contemporary norms. But what you're talking about seems a heck of a lot more complicated.
Yeah, it's gotten a lot more complicated. The reason I got so fascinated by this was I just have, for months and months, been still puzzling over Justice Kennedy's majority opinion in the same-sex marriage case from 2015.
Why so?
Because he goes on and on. He quotes Cicero. He quotes it. He talks about ancient Greece and ancient Rome, and it's just, it's full of a fairly extraordinary historical rumination. And when you see that much history in a Supreme Court opinion, just as your question suggests, it tends to be from conservatives. That is to say, the emphasis on history and tradition tends to come from conservatives. Because if you think about it, many of the rights that people have been fighting for, certainly since Brown v. Board of Education in 1954, are rights that earlier generations of Americans did not have. If you're trying to call for ending segregation, desegregating the schools, history's not the place to go for your argument, since segregation had been an American tradition. So most rights cases that came from the left or from liberals in the second half of the 20th century threw away history and tradition and argued using other forms of judicial reasoning, mostly, but also using other kinds of evidence, like social science.
Jill, a word that we hear, a concept that we hear all the time is originalism, and it's associated with the conservative side of things of the justices. But can we define what originalism means exactly?
Originalism was coined in 1980 and became the hallmark of the Reagan-era Justice Department. It means that the best way to interpret the law and all constitutional questions is to look for the original meaning and the original intention of the framers of the Constitution. So originalism has many adherents, but on the Supreme Court, Antonin Scalia was by far the most powerful of them and the most eloquent, a really terrific spokesperson for this set of ideas. And after Scalia died, Neil Gorsuch gave a tribute address at Case Western Law School in which he talked about what it was that Scalia had contributed to American jurisprudence.
Perhaps the great project of the justice's career was to remind us of the differences between judges and legislators, to remind us that legislators may appeal to their own moral convictions and to claims about social utility to reshape the law as they think it should be in the future. But the judges should do none of those things in a democratic society. The judges should instead strive, if humanly and so imperfectly, to apply the law as they find it, focusing backwards, not forwards, and looking to text, structure, and history, not their moral convictions or policy consequences they think best for society. As Justice Scalia put it, and it rings true to me, if you're going to be a good and faithful judge, you have to resign yourself to the fact that you're not always going to like the conclusions you reach. If you like them all the time, you're probably doing something wrong.
But Jill, it sometimes seems like where the justices start is where they want the decision to land. And then they work backwards to find the history to justify that decision. Is that fair, that it's more politics than they'd like to admit?
I completely share your tendency to see it that way, but I don't think that's entirely fair. I do think that justices believe that they are examining the case on the merits and that their understanding of history is so structured as to result in the outcome that they favor, but that they might see that it's history that's dictating that ruling rather than their politics. So I think what happens when liberals argue from empirical research, social science data, to argue against desegregation and to argue for women's rights and gay rights and same-sex marriage rights, what happens in the 1970s is that conservatives come up with their own judicial philosophy that is essentially a very narrow use of history, which is originalism. And that's where you get liberals using history differently and casting back, kind of out-originalizing originalists, casting back. No, we'll give you ancient history. Let me go to Cicero. And that's where that move comes in, right? It's the left saying, okay, we have who's going to bring the best history to this game? I have better history than you. My history is more interesting. My history is more thorough. My history has a longer timeline, especially in the same-sex marriage debates, right? It's the historical research of a generation of scholars that really makes a difference. Originalism is in a certain kind of crisis, having risen to prominence not only on the court but in American public opinion. But these larger historical arguments that liberals have been making have been very successful both in the public's mind and also on the court. So Gorsuch has written very specifically about the question of the history test, and I think fairly candidly states, depends what history you're looking at, whose history, how far back are you going to go. If you want to find justification for a decision you're going to make, you can cater your historical research to find that answer and to justify that position. Gorsuch has been very frank about that in his own writing.
One of the things that caught my eye in your essay is that you said that the framers themselves were not originalists. What did you mean by that?
So think about the revolution in the first place, the war for American independence. Its whole use of history is to say, let's just set history aside. History is a set of injuries committed against us by the King of England. What history tells us is that a people have a right to revolt. But we don't mean to make ourselves blindly venerate tradition. People in power often found their tyranny in an argument about the past. So we must always be able to criticize the past.
It almost seems like a kind of a fundamentalist view of a religious text.
Right. And legal scholars who have done careful work trying to understand why originalism exists in this country, there's this guy at Columbia Law School named Jamal Green, who's done a really interesting comparative study. So he looks at Australia and Canada in particular. Former English colonies, they have written constitutions. They have nothing like originalism in their political culture.
Why?
He looks at a number of possible factors, and he decides it's because they don't have fundamentalist Protestantism in the country. And he argues that originalism, its appeal to the public, not necessarily to justices, but its appeal to the public, lies in how closely it aligns with fundamentalism, that what you read in the gospel is the literal truth of God, and that it is a revealed text in the same way that many originalists believe the Constitution to be divinely inspired. Who's waving the Constitution now is the political question, I think, worth asking.
Jill, thank you so much.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, David.
Jill Lepore is a professor of history at Harvard University and a staff writer at The New Yorker.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.